WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine, hailing from Texas. We have Gavin here with us today. Welcome to The Angry Young Man.
Hello.
Yeah, so I had a couple things that would be interesting for us to talk about. I know there was something you wanted to talk about, but I've been reading what some may call the book of the year so far. I'm reading Abundance by Ezra Klein.
I have a copy of that.
You have a copy of that? I just now got a copy because they had, ironically, Abundance was not abundant for a period of time. I just got a copy of it. It's interesting because, you know, if for those of you who have listened to the show before, you'll know that I have a little bit of a fixation with housing. But it's interesting to see, you know, this argument for abundance liberalism and talking about using state capacity to kind of pursue growth and look at these things. I've only gotten about 30 pages into it so far. There's some things that I agree with. There's some things I disagree with. But I guess we'll start off this segment by kind of getting at that. I mean, Gavin, would you consider yourself an abundance liberal?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I agree with the idea. I don't know.
I mean,
how would you define abundance liberal? And we'll go from there.
Well, I find it kind of the defining factor that separates it, the abundance liberal from, say, you know, the free market absolutist or fundamentalist, is the idea that there's a necessity to use state capacity to go after both supply and demand. I mean, they look at it as, and they open in the book by saying that, you know, for so long, because the fundamental kind of crux of economics is supply and demand, how it's been divided in half, and each side of the political spectrum has kind of made one of those their baby, in the sense that the right has been entirely supply focused and the left has been entirely demand focused. And, you know, the lack of understanding that both have their own importance, because they are supply and demand, not just supply or just demand. They kind of advocate for the, you know, the pushing of both to go about things. I mean, I have my fair share of disagreements kind of going out the gate with some of the claims, specifically as they relate to using state capacity to push for a lot of these things or to subsidize demand. Or to look for some of those things. They may be addressed later in the book. I haven't gotten just far into it just yet. But I mean, I'm curious, to what degree do you subscribe to those sorts of claims? And if so, what's your critique of say the market fundamentalist approach that I'm sure, you know, you're aware that I hold on this matter?
Yeah, I'd say, in all things, in housing, which is our first topic, in food and water, there we have, I guess, the title of the book. We already have a superabundance of all of these things. We have enough where if we had the perfect allocation of resources, a perfect system, nobody would ever starve. Because we have more food than anyone could eat. We have more housing. We have more homes than homeless people. All of these things. So we're at a point now where it's not really a matter of how do we grow food? How do we have more houses? How do we have enough for everyone to survive? Which is what most of human history was about. And we now are at a point of, okay, how do we think about our systems to have them structured in such a way that everyone has enough. And I think that's kind of where we should be going forward as a society at this point. So especially in terms of housing, I don't think we should accept homeless people as a concept at all. And if that means somebody has like a homeless shelter, that's like a little studio apartment, then that's what that is. I think you should be given the bare minimum. And I think beyond that, if you want to work for something harder, absolutely. Like even, and this is where I'm going to lose people, but like even if you're like a drug addict and you want to be in your home all day doing drugs, I don't think you should have a particularly good quality of life. I don't think, because you're not contributing to society at all, but I don't think it's very ethical to say somebody should die in that circumstance, just should be on the street and have no societal support. And it's not even like an ethical thing. Like homeless people are a drain on society as they exist. If they overdose, that's a drain on our medical system. If they live in like a northern climate, Pittsburgh, whatever, and it's the winter and they have pneumonia or frostbite or whatever. I don't know. I'm from Texas, so I don't know what happens when you get cold. It's a mystery. That's also a drain on the medical system. If they do a crime because they're so desperate and hungry and they have to go to prison, that's a drain on our prison system. So I think overall, you can even make an argument that just housing these people would be a cost-saving measure for society, for taxpayers overall. So that's sort of my position.
So, I mean, one of the kind of key things I want to zone in on, no pun intended, is, you know, you mentioned, you know, the crisis of homelessness, and something that they bring up very quickly in the section on at the outset is this idea of, you know, why do we have homelessness? Why does this happen? And, mm-hmm. you know, they kind of zone in on the fact that more often than not, it's a cost issue, you know, in terms of how much the homes cost. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily agree that we have enough housing or an abundance of housing. You know, at least in our metropolitan areas, there's not an abundance in the sense that we're able to address the massive demand of these areas. You'll look at states like California and New York that have been historically and notoriously bad at trying to address these issues with their zoning policies. I mean, you can drag in redlining if you really wanted to, but you know, it kind of falls down on this issue of there's this strand of liberal policy which has attempted to restrict supply, and as a result has caused the crisis of homelessness, because all of these other things that we look at as a result, where you have the drug epidemic as a result, or turning to violence, these are symptoms of the problem, not necessarily the problem in of themselves. So I mean, at least coming from my part of things, you know, you can address the cost issue at no cost by pulling back on a lot of these regulations that states like California and New York have been putting so much effort into holding up, and or at least have felt the pressure from the NIMBYs in their respective communities to uphold these regulations, which quite frankly, it doesn't really cost anything materially outside of maybe the administrative cost of just kind of keeping the lights on while you're debating it. You know, for you to roll back these things, and you already experience so much change from there that, you know, it's an ambiguous amount of change. You know, how much are you going to make a dent in the homeless population? How much are housing prices going to fall down? But you could look at some pretty good case examples. You know, in your home state of Texas, I believe it was Austin that just recently saw rents tumble about 20% because the housing stock went up. You know, and that's it ultimately falls down to, you know, can you allow the market to address demand? I mean, if you're getting rid of these artificial caps, that should do enough in of itself. And then you kind of ask the question, well, is it necessary for us to start subsidizing demand again. On your front of things, it would appear that your position, to an extent, requires some amount of subsidizing demand, or doing some sort of subsidy to allow for access to housing. So I'm curious if that, you know, how that would play out, and to what degree the government or state capacity to act would be necessary if you were able to pull back on just the caps on supply.
Yeah, so just to re-clarify my position, like, obviously right now, there is a lot of cities where the housing situation is so far not great, not conducive to like universal housing. How do I put this? Like you were saying, like, rents are exorbitantly high in Los Angeles and New York. But I think my position is this is not like a human economic. Like, we have the labor capacity, we have the technology to build enough homes for everyone to live, just simply, just as simple as that. So then the question becomes, why don't we have that? I think you adequately addressed some of these issues. All of it is just policy issues, basically. Some of it might be like cultural or whatever, but I feel like the vast majority is policy. These are policy decisions that are very deliberately put in place. A lot of it is like the YIMBY NIMBY debate. I was going to pick up Austin myself because it's an example I'm well aware of. It's right in my neighborhood, so to speak. Austin has grown so much. You can look at a skyline picture of like Austin in 2015 versus Austin today, and it's like, it looks like a different city. And this isn't like because nobody wants, rents are also super low in Austin. And there's like two sides of that. There's supply and demand. And one might be tempted to say, well, nobody wants to live in Austin, but that's just not the case. You ask anybody.
Do you want to live in Austin?
I'd like to. Like, everyone wants to live in Austin. Austin's the cool place to live. It's like the LA of Texas. Like, people want to go there. So it's clearly not like a low demand thing. It's, they're doing something right. I think they've enacted good policies. Houston has done similar things. They have very, very notoriously soft zoning policies. So there's that, obviously. I think you would have to have a very strong state capacity if you wanted to like provide a universal layer of guaranteed homelessness. But I think it is possible. I think a really good example of this is Japan. Japan is a country of almost a billion people, right?
A good amount.
I don't know.
Not off the top of my head, but yeah,
maybe like, okay, 100 million. Okay, not nearly as much as I thought, but...
a lot of people. We'll put it that way.
They have, in their entire country, about 2,000 homeless people. And this is like in Tokyo. Like if there was a city the size of Tokyo in the US, there would be like a bajillion homeless people. So clearly like Japan is doing something right. And I think a big thing is that they have a pretty generous welfare system there. That kind of just doesn't accept homelessness is this thing. And I think a lot of it in Japan is also a cultural thing. Like this culture of there's a very, very strong stigma around homelessness and also like around hospitality. But I think a lot of it is like statewide decisions on the part of a government to support like very strong housing policies, because Tokyo is another place that has notoriously very low rents for a city of its size.
Well, I think you can look
at Tokyo also has very, very you know, not great houses, but like these tiny, tiny little condos that people have.
Yeah, and that's
I think
kind of...
that's fine. That's great. That beats living on the street.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of things that I would want. I would want like not a great quality of housing. Because obviously like cost is a worry, but like anything's better than people living on the streets.
Yeah.
So if there's a way to do this with like it being entirely free market, I would like that. But so far I haven't seen a good case of this being done like entirely through market forces and market incentives. So just to go back to your question, yeah, I think you would have to have a pretty strong government program for this to work.
I guess the one thing, and I will kind of pivot from there, is, you know, in the case of Japan, they have extreme, especially Tokyo, extreme density, which allows, uh-huh. you know, is a supply thing. They have enormous supply.
Sure.
I mean, maybe it's not the best supply. You mentioned that, you know, they're not the best apartments, but it's supply nevertheless, which allows, you know, rents to go down like that. You know, there was a lot to consider, I guess, very briefly, because I know there's a bigger topic we want to get to. While we're on the topic of other nations, you know, immigration never ceases to be a topic of interest. I know we have very many overlapping positions on this, but I guess the thing I wanted to probe you on a little bit was, as it relates to... The illegal nature of crossings, you know, be it for someone who's, you know, either of ill intent or not, I guess, you know, because we definitely agree, you know, there needs to be reform in the system as it relates to making it easier to immigrate. But as it relates to people who do come illegally, if you do go about treating it as a criminal offense, being that it you know, it is a crossing that is not legal. So I'm curious to probe your thoughts on that, especially being from a border state. Kind of very briefly, what you think?
I have to organize my thoughts for a second. Sorry. I feel like when we call it like this illegal, like it moralizes it a lot that they've done some big crime. And I just don't see illegal things as necessarily morally bad things. You know, you can imagine a situation like a mother stealing food for her starving kids. I don't see that as morally bad. And a lot of the times, this illegal immigration is a similar thing. It's these people in very, very desperate situations, so desperate that like I can't even imagine having to make some of these decisions. I know in the case of a very famous case recently of I'm not sure exactly what his name is. I think it's Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
Yes, the Venezuelan gentleman.
El Salvadorian.
Oh, sorry. We're jumping between El Salvador and Venezuela so much right now in the news.
Yeah.
Get the streams crossed. But yes.
He was coming to the United States because a gang back in El Salvador was threatening the life of him and his family. And he came here and he worked in the United States. He has a pretty good paying job. He's contributing to the economy. He's paying taxes. He's buying local goods. He has a family. He has a wife who's an American citizen. He has a... kids here. And even though, yes, he came here illegally originally, I'm not comfortable saying he's any less American than you and me. And so it's sort of a case-by-case basis like that. If they're coming here to do terrible things, then obviously I'm not happy with that. If they're here to do crimes, if they're here to smuggle drugs, that's not great. But I don't think that's the vast majority of the people who are being deported right now. So I think you'd have to deal with that on a case-by-case basis, decide, is this person well integrated in the American society and the American economy? Are they contributing to our economy? And did they come here under a situation of distress? I think those are all considerations you have to make in these cases, and I think more often than not, I would like these people to stay here because it is a good thing for immigrants to be here, and it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement. That, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
I mean, yeah. Neither of us are Native Americans, I don't think. Imagine. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans, so we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're still talking about, irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even a moral ambiguity, you know, there is a law that's broken, and I think that's, you know, the kind of the key core and principle thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, there it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. You know, yes. I would assume this is of a broad sort of heady general what do we think here, but I'm getting, is there something specifically that you wanted to touch on?
So this is for a class project of mine, obviously. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. So there's this sort of model of three different models of marriage. So there's this idea of a traditional marriage. This is what you imagine, like the housewife. You know, the wife typically doesn't work. If she does, it's like maybe a part-time job. She does the majority of the housework, the majority of taking care of kids. And then there is this neo-traditional model. Let's hold that thought. Let's go to the opposite end. There's this progressive model where this is what, like, a very egalitarian person would advocate all marriage should look like. You know, equal, both the mother and the father are breadwinners. You know, they might have roughly equal incomes, and they split housework, they split caring for the kids equally amongst them. And then there's this neo-traditional model, which is a bit of a mix of the two, of this. Basically, the mother does work, but she also does the brunt of the housework, of the taking care of the kids. And I wonder, of those three models of marriage, which of those would sound the most appealing to you? Which of those do you believe not our society should be structured on, but which do you believe you would want your ideal marriage to look like?
Oh, this is interesting. We're breaking from the politics here on the show, which is cool, I guess.
Let's say scaling it down to a microscopic level.
I guess we can say that. I mean, listen, I'm in many ways I'm an old school guy. You know, that's just the kind of world I grew up in. More often than not, the type of people of my background gravitate towards the neo-traditional in a lot of ways. Because I think this is also informed in a lot of ways by my faith. I definitely think, you know, as a Catholic, you know, there's this, in conception of marriage, we define, you know, separate but equally important roles for both the man and the woman in the relationship. And I think, you know, this is kind of the thing that's lost on a lot of people when they look at the Catholic or, you know, even generally Christian conceptions of marriage between a man and a woman, because It's, you know, obviously there are certain things that both the man and the woman have going on for their respective roles in the marriage, but they are of equal importance, and there's equal accountability between both halves to hold up their end of the bargain. And I don't think that the neo-traditional model really deviates much from that, from the traditional, in so much as it still maintains kind of the core essence of what's going on, with some, you know, realities that kind of reflect back on potentially some of the socioeconomic factors we have to kind of put into consideration for a lot of families that are currently trying to make ends meet and need to live on two incomes. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely not easy in New York to afford to live there, when the median households the median house price selling in my home county is almost $750,000. It's ludicrous. So, you know, I definitely I can say that I would kind of bounce between the two. But, you know, obviously as a libertarian, so long as you're not hurting other people, I'm very much of the opinion that you, you know, pursue the model that works for you. But I'm curious then, you know, is there any kind of further consideration from that you wanted to touch on? Or if, I mean, where you personally kind of fall on that? Where does that kind of pan out for you?
So for me personally, obviously, I'm a very progressive person, so I think that's the type of model I would want. I would want sort of shared responsibility, both parents having relatively equal status, income levels. And this is sort of the environment I was raised in. My parents, sometimes some would lean a little bit more, but generally I feel like both my mom and my dad had a very big role in raising me. So I'm curious, you said that in your faith, both the men and the women have these separate but equally important roles. So I'm curious, what would you conceive as the role for the man in a marriage?
I mean, he's the primary provider, you know, and mm-hmm. this kind of falls back into, you know, sure, there can be, you know,
so like kind of this breadwinner role.
Yeah, and you know, at the same time, you know, the woman, you know, can, and if she has the desire to do so, should pursue, you know, a source of income as well. But you know, the conception is, you know, that there's the primary role in the part of the man to do so, being kind of the ultimate defender of the family, things of that sort, you know, which is mirrored in a lot of ways by the nature of both men and women in just kind of how there's a kind of attitude of what manhood is and what womanhood is that's presented through the Bible, which mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't mean that it's kind of cut and dry, this is the case. I mean, you know, obviously we're not, you know, from the perspective of faith, we're all made in God's image, but we have varieties upon which that is different. But you know, there's kind of broad generalizations that encompass certain deviations as well that just are brought forth by the Bible. And I did actually do a very interesting Bible study a while back on, you know, mm-hmm. what does the Bible say about manhood? What does it mean to be a man? What are the virtues inherent to masculinity? We're kind of in the last minute here. I mean, any kind of closing thoughts there that you wanted to bring in?
No, this has been really, really great. A good conversation, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, it's always so crazy how fast the time goes. You know, it is.
Yeah, I was very surprised about that.
it makes you yearn for the days of ye old tavern, you know, the coffee, whatever you wanted, the salon. But anyways, thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure to have you, and I hope you guys enjoyed having, you know, an actual guest on the show once again. But I'll send you all off with this. You all have a wonderful rest of your day. Take care, and God bless.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Welcome to our public affairs show for this week. Don Lennon in the spotlight.
Now, I'm not sure how much of it is satire, how much of it is real. Well, there's enough of it that's real that we're gonna talk about it. That people are regretting their vote. Are you tired yet? Are you wondering, like, wait, my relatives are being deported? Oh, wait a minute. What happened? Eggs are higher than when Joe Biden was in office. Wait, what do you mean? I can't get my Medicare? Like, wait, what? What is going on? What happened? I thought he was going to do a carve out for me. That he was going to make an exception for me. What about me? And he didn't. And now you're an FAFO. Everyone from teachers to farmers to everyday people. Even some of the folks who said who just did not want to go back to work, like you supported Donald Trump, but you thought you'd be able to work from home. And then he's like, no, bring your ass back to work. Come into the office. And now you mad because of that. Why are you mad, bro? Why are you mad? Thank you, Jen Leonard. I will feel better soon. I just need to get more and more sleep. Thank you, Violet Ray. I appreciate it. Feel better. Take lemons. I will. I have lemons, and I got some lemon tea right here. So thank you all. I really appreciate it. But we got some business to do this morning. So come on in, everyone. Where are you streaming from? Let me know, and let me know, do you care? Do you know anyone who's regretting their vote? Now, I'm sure some people are loving it, right? Because, oh, we're owning the libs, and this is what we want. Whatever. It's not really what they want. They're going to tell you that. They're lying to you because I know some MAGA folks and they're like, wait a minute, what is all of this? I didn't expect all of this chaos. I thought everything was going to go down and it hasn't. And it's about to go up, especially with these tariffs. So do not get it twisted. Forget about the price of eggs, the price of houses. It's about to go through the roof. You thought that you couldn't afford the American dream. You thought that you couldn't afford the American dream. Wait till now. Wait till these tariffs on steel and metal and all that, and aluminum, or as they say, aluminium, across the pond. Wait till these tariffs go in and see if you were ever able to afford the American dream in the near or even far future. It's not going to happen. The price of houses is about to go through the roof. President Donald Trump has ordered a 25% import tax on all steel and aluminum entering the U.S. in a major expansion of existing trade barriers. The tariffs, which will increase the costs of importing the metals into the U.S., come despite warnings of retaliation from some political leaders in Canada, America's biggest supplier of metals, as well as other countries. It's not just Canada's like, we don't need you. We got our own syrup. We got our own metals. We got our own aluminum. You need ours. So do your thing, America, Trump. That's honestly what they're saying. All of this has prompted the trend on social media, hashtag MAGA regrets. Do you know some folks who are regretting? This is a mashup of tons of voters saying that they now regret voting for Donald Trump. Again, we don't know. Some of it may be satire, but we know that a lot of it's real because I have encountered some of these folks. But here it is. Watch.
In 2 weeks, I'm done. You want to talk about regretting your vote?
I never thought I'd say that, but I regret my vote. I voted for Trump.
I voted for Trump, and I regret it now.
I, as a Hispanic, I voted for Donald J. Trump. Dude, I regret it so much, man.
I am regretting my vote for Donald Trump.
I voted for Donald Trump, and now I regret it because...
A lot of people who were like me voted for Trump and have to account for that.
I regret voting for Trump.
So deeply regret my vote for Donald Trump.
I regret voting for Trump.
I was a dumbass, voted for Trump. It was the worst decision I ever made.
I've seen the light, and I got out of MAGA. A lot of us there have seen the light. We have deep regrets.
I feel guilty because I voted for Trump twice. I feel very guilty because I feel responsible. That's why he's still running.
I was with Trump for 9 straight years. I'm disappointed. I'm very disappointed in Trump right now.
So Marie Maniscalco says, I work with some of them. I see no signs of regret yet. That's true. And we're going to tell you why. There are some who are not regretting, but there are some who are. And I think you can take them, the folks who are regretting, you have to welcome them in. Like the guy said to me, they welcomed him in to the Capitol for the insurrectionists. He actually believed that the police welcomed them in. So I think you have to meet people where they are. Yes. Yes. Aw, cry me a river, says Britt Wilson. Yes, they should face responsibility. They got themselves into this. They got all of us into this. Why did they vote for him? But KT Frey, they voted for him because they thought that he was going to actually lower the cost of goods, of groceries. And that is not happening. None of it is happening. All he's doing is what? Playing on the American people's emotions about issues that don't even really matter. Like changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Just little things like that. There's a map. You can put it up, Andy. It changed the name of the... So you think that he's doing something, right? Do you really care? Do you really care if he changes the name? Because someone can just go in and change it back. Do you really care? People are going to call it the Gulf of Mexico anyways. But he's doing it because he wants you to think that he's doing something, and he's just putting, bombarding you with BS, 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 BS. I don't care how much they regret it, says Jay Jenkins. Well, you should care. You should care, and you should say, you know, I told you so, but come on in. Talk to me about why you regret it. Why do you regret it? Now, I think that the people who regret it most, quite honestly, are the teachers and the farmers. Because when you get rid of the Department of Education, and when you get rid of things that are going to help the farming industry in this country, that you actually make it harder in an industry that already has it the worst. Those folks don't take to it kindly. Here's farmers. These are farmers expressing their regret for MAGA.
Folks who aren't feeling Trump's optimism right now are American farmers, and they are stuck in the middle of all of this.
Frank, who did you vote for president?
Mr. Trump.
Right?
Trump.
Mr. Trump.
If the election were today, Frank, would you vote for Donald Trump?
No way.
Couldn't happen.
No.
You voted for President Trump. So now, in this moment, you say you're in a free fall. What is your message to him?
So I'm off the Trump train. Where I'm going for now is I got to protect my business.
Island, a wheat farmer who says he's lost $400,000 since Trump took office.
I think there was a lot of people who voted for him that want to stay loyal to him, but it's going to get to the point where financially, if it's between supporting the president or losing your family farm.
You voted for the president?
Yes, I did.
And do you support these policies which might be hurting farmers like you?
Right now, we're the ones that are taking the hit.
I think he's sort of backstabbing the main people who got him into office in the Midwest, and he just left us down.
So, yesterday, we put up on our channel, farmers, a farmer who regret, well, he didn't vote for Donald Trump. But he says that Donald Trump is betraying the farming industry. And some of the folks he speaks to, he said they're reluctant to admit it. He said, so if you can't regret and you don't believe that you FAFO'd, then can you at least, he says, admit that you were lied to? And they all admit that they were lied to. Because it's hard for people to get into their heads like, oh, my God, I did something wrong. But now they're admitting at least that they're lied to. That's the first step, is acknowledgement. Now, this is the farmer we spoke to yesterday. His name is Will Westmoreland. Here he is.
I live in the middle of it. Almost every Saturday I go have lunch with the same group of friends that I've had for years. And they all voted for Donald J. Trump. And I hear the same thing now, although I will say it's starting to change. The first cracks in the foundation are occurring. You heard the same thing before the election. Well, he's only going to deport the criminals. He's not going to do these things to farmers and ranchers. There was this deeply seated belief out there that it was all going to happen to somebody else, the people that deserved it. And now it's happening to us. And that was their biggest reason, I think, for trying to justify their vote. Well, now the chickens are coming home to roost. And what I tried to do in that video and what I'm pushing with my group, the Back 40, is I'm trying to say, while we're actively fighting against these policies that are bad for farmers and ranchers, We have to be willing to extend an olive branch to people like Skyler that say, I may have made the wrong decision. Educate me on these topics. We've got to be willing to do that.
Skyler is a rancher that Will reached out to. Will saw Skyler online saying that folks were lying, that Donald Trump had nothing to do with Project 2025. He didn't believe it. And then Will got in touch with him and educated him on it. Because everything that Donald Trump is implementing comes from Project 2025. Even the bullshit stuff. That means nothing. That he's just throwing at you to distract you. The fact that these voters are regretting their vote shows that there is hope. Coming on in MAGA regrets. Join us to enforce the Constitution, says Jose Hernandez. Jose, thank you for your support of independent media. Yes. Look, I think these folks should be held accountable. But I think now that they're really finding out, perhaps they can help with this with the constitutional crisis that we're in. Charisse Peoples, they voted for racism, Don, not eggs. Deportations, they did. You're 100% correct. Here's a TikToker saying, you made this bed, MAGA. Lay in it. Here it is.
I have a couple comments and a prediction on this MAGA regret thing that seems to be trending. First off, we told you so for years, what he's intending to do. We kept saying Project 2025, and you kept saying no. We kept saying dictatorship, and you kept saying no. We kept saying he doesn't care about you. He just cares about your votes. And you kept saying, he was joking. And a lot of you are realizing we were right. And then there's a lot of you who think that Donald Trump should give you an exception to what everybody else is going through because you voted for him. And you're thinking that Trump is going to make stipulations in executive orders because he's not going legislatively. This is all executive orders. That he's going to make a stipulation saying, well, if you voted for me, then this doesn't affect you. And therein lies my prediction that he'll toy with that idea.
Yeah, but he's never going to
perhaps even put in that rule. But then again, he just cared about their vote. He didn't really care about them.
He's never going to make a stipulation. That's not what's happening here. He only cared about your vote. And so for the ones who are not regretting right now, because I know there are some of them who are not regretting and they think like, oh, this is daddy. And they will. Mark my words. But again, cry me a river. If you voted for the deporter in chief, and your family members are getting deported, then that's all on you. If you voted for cutting education funds, and he's getting rid of the Department of Education, and you're a teacher, that is all on you. Like this teacher in a red state, here's Luke Beasley. Watch.
States that most rely on federal funding for its public schools all voted for Trump.
I voted for President Trump.
You didn't vote for Trump eliminating federal funds.
No, here. I did not vote for that. I voted for President Trump to make America first again. I do not think that's what the voters want. It's devastating.
Do you know what getting rid of the Department of Education, getting rid of the mechanisms by which that support is delivered? It means it goes away. Trying to uplift states that are experiencing major either shortcomings, failures in governance, or just happen to be for systemic reasons, struggling more. No matter how much you may hate me, MAGA, I want you to get that extra support. But Trump wants to get rid of it, and it would be devastating. She's realizing how messed up this would be for her after voting for it. When you look at these women, I don't want to go, well, you're going to get what you voted for. No, even if she's actively enabling the problem, I want to push back against that problem. One of the most admirable jobs, and so important. But we have to get through that you can't vote for the people saying they want to hurt you.
Well, they did, Luke Beasley. And now they regret it. At least the people who are living in the real world, like the people who are not teachers are not farmers and they just think that they know what everybody wants, they're sitting around going, oh, I love this, I love this, I love this. But the people who are actually affected by it, the folks who know, if you get rid of the Department of Education and folks are going to have to start paying for their schools and it's going to be school choice and all of that, then they know that public education is going away. So unless you are someone who is wealthy or well-to-do, upper middle class, you can afford maybe to send your kids to private school, you're going to be okay. But other than that, you got to pay. And let's not forget the price of those eggs that there were, he was supposed to bring down in the first couple of days after he took office. And guess what? They've skyrocketed. For really the same reasons that they were high under President Joe Biden. It's a bird flu. But under Joe Biden, nobody believed the bird flu, smird flu. It's a fake birdemic. It's a flapdemic. It's not true. Joe Biden is lying. And now because Donald Trump is in office, oh yeah, well, he can't control the bird flu. Dude, people are so dumb. It's unbelievable. Now, this is how many people, you've heard black women say, you know what? I'm done with this. I'm sitting out. Don't ask me. This woman that I'm going to show, and it's a little bit humorous, but it's true. A lot of people in the country who really fought for the right things, who voted not just for themselves, but for their fellow men, for other people, not just selfishly. This is how they feel. They're just sitting back and watching this. Watch.
Voted for Trump because he promised while he was campaigning like a million times that when he got into office, he was going to bring down prices, bring down grocery prices. The inflation has been high ever since COVID, and he promised he would bring that down. But it's obvious to me now that that was not true. Egg prices have skyrocketed. The bird flu is killing all the birds, and he doesn't seem to be doing anything about that. He's stopping disease. Communications from the disease centers in America pulled us out of the WHO. Like, how does that help anything? And yeah, all he's been doing is taking away rights and freedoms, or trying to. He's not doing anything about the economy. So yeah, we totally regret our vote at this point. We've had a really tough time here in North Carolina. Half of my house got washed away in Hurricane Helene, and I applied for FEMA assistance and we got approved. But now Trump is canceling FEMA and emergency assistance to people. He's also canceled Medicaid for my children. I know they said they put a halt on his freezing of the funds, but the Medicaid portal is still not working, so we can't access.
That's some real stuff. Now, we're not laughing at people being hurt. We're not laughing at the folks who are in the storm zone, in the hurricane zone, because those folks are really hurting. But you voted for this because you thought that you were owning the libs and you believed the lies. You believed the lies that come out of his mouth every single day. How could you, after 10 years of him being in the political spotlight, that you could do it? And now you're saying he's hurting my family. Other families have been saying that forever. Black families, the Central Park Five, been saying, hey, look, he wanted to unalive us. And you still voted for him. And not until it affects your family. Now all of a sudden you're crying about it. And especially those who are, I have no respect, honestly, for anyone who does not understand the contributions and the sacrifices that African Americans, black folks, have made for this country. And also in helping women of all ethnicities with their rights, of helping all other ethnicities through the Civil Rights Act and the Civil Rights Movement. And then all of a sudden you get into the country, you become a citizen, you gain a little bit of money or wealth or ease in society. And then all of a sudden you forget about the people who actually helped you. Vivek, Nikki. Because without us, you would not be where you are. Latinos who voted for Trump. Just think, if African Americans had not made the sacrifices, where you would be. And then you just forget about black people and you forget about the people who helped you. Here's a man on Latino MAGA, regret, watch.
Latinos for Trump literally in tears because ICE is picking up their family members saying that Trump betrayed them. No, Trump didn't lie to you. You lied to you. Can somebody tell me a single nice thing Trump has ever said about Latinos? I never recall this dude saying, you know, we love the Mexicans, don't we? So hardworking, so intelligent, they're bringing the best, said Trump.
Never. Pause, please, Andy. He didn't lie to you. You lied to you. Andy, do you have the clip of what he said about Latinos? Let's show. This is how he feels about you, yet you supported him. Watch.
When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity. And now they're beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me. And these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting. And it only makes common sense. It only makes common sense.
Okay, there you go.
Yes.
So he says they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crimes, they're rapists. Some, I assume, are good people. And you voted for him. And now he's deporting your family members. Can we go back to the man? Can we pick up the man where he was? Is that possible? Because he didn't lie to you. You lied to you, Dearborn, Michigan. He didn't lie to you. You lied to you. I feel bad for the people, what's happening in Gaza and Palestine. But he told you where his loyalties lied. And that was not with the folks in Gaza. It was with Bibi Netanyahu. I'm just saying, roll the tape.
In fact, white MAGA is calling La Migra on brown MAGA, but Trump didn't lie. Your desire for adjacency to whiteness was the deceiver. These F around and find out stories are abounding, and we ain't even 2 weeks in yet. You got the Fraternal Order of Police upset at Trump because he released January Sixers. Trump didn't lie to you. You lied to
you. Lied to
Trump's credit, he never said he wasn't going to let them people out. Red State farmers mad at Trump because nobody is there to pick the produce off the vine. Trump didn't lie to you. You lied to you. Trump told you good and damn well what he was going to do with the migrants. The self-deception was falling for them white supremacist dog whistles and letting them trick you into thinking that brown folks was your problem in this country. No. It's always been wealthy white men. Most asinine groups is the black MAGA voters who also believe in reparations. And they actually asked me, because of my proximity to Bobby Kennedy, do you think that this administration would have a hearing on reparations? And I'm like, nah, man.
No.
These same people act like they don't mind DEI going away because reparations is what we need. I'm like, dude, DEI is the canary in the coal mine to reparations.
There you go.
You know this? You got to be politically astute enough to.
You got to be politically astute enough to understand. They don't care about you. All of that protest voting and, oh my gosh, it's not. I can't believe that, you know, Harris is doing this and Biden didn't do this and blah, blah, blah. And what about this? And Jill Stein. And it's like, oh my God, give me a break. You were idiots. Yeah, I said it. It was the dumbest thing that you could have done, because look where you are now. I hate to laugh, but it's your fault. This gentleman is right. He didn't lie to you. You lied to you. Now, I don't want anyone to not feed their family, to lose their homes or their jobs, or not to be able to send their kids to school. But he told you. So all of those people who are regretting, that is your own fault. And guess what? There are some, for the folks who are regretting, because there are a lot of people who are regretting, even your own MAGA folks are laughing at you because they don't care. They're happy about it. Nathan June says, MAGA doesn't actually regret anything. That's what he says. Watch.
I don't know who needs to hear this, but there are very few MAGA people who actually regret voting for Trump right now. Yeah, groceries aren't any cheaper. They don't care. I promise you they don't care. Because what they actually care about is DEI programs ending. What they actually care about is controlling women's bodies. What they actually care about is 40 trans athletes not being able to play field hockey in Division II anymore.
40.
What they actually care about is forcing prayer in schools. So yeah, it's fun to see these videos where like a handful of people are saying that they regret their choice because it directly impacts them, but it's not the case. Almost half of the executive orders that Trump has signed in his first 2 weeks are about equal rights, human rights, and forcing Christianity on Americans.
Mm-hmm.
It was never about groceries. And it was never about eggs, because if it was about eggs, he would be trying to fix the eggs problem.
And he's not, because he can't, and he never could. Now, I believe, look, doing my own research, it's more than a handful of people. That's where I don't agree with him on. Now we're all suffering, except the super wealthy, says Miss A. Renee Moore. You're right. The super wealthy is not suffering. We're going to hear from some of the folks, like Elizabeth Warren and folks about the super wealthy in just a bit. Now, think about this. Now, I want you to imagine if everything that's happening now, and I've done this a little experiment with you guys before. If everything that's happening now, if there was a Democrat in office, and then there was George Soros, and George Soros had an office of the Department of Government Oversight or Waste or whatever it is, and he was calling the shots and firing people and getting rid of money and freezing it or whatever. How would the Republicans feel? This is a dictatorship. Oh, my God, we can't do it. Joe Biden is doing it, Barack Obama, Kamala Harris. What are they doing? George Soros, devil. But they're okay with it. They're okay with a dictatorship. Did you hear what I said? Now, this is America. It's a democracy. It's a republic. But do you think Americans, especially Republicans or conservatives, do you think they would be okay with a dictatorship? You know, a constitution. You know, God doesn't make kings. You know the reason that we left England. Do you think that MAGA would be okay with a dictatorship? Well, here's your answer. Watch.
Do you rather have 4 years of Donald Trump as a dictator or 4 years of President Biden reelected?
You know, you don't have to like the words that come out of the man's mouth, but sometimes in life we all need a good paddling from the principal to set our life on the right track, and this country does need a little bit of that. We need a little paddling. I mean, I was a problem child growing up, and it took a good leadership to set me straight. So I think our country does need some of that. So I hands down believe people wanted it 4 years ago, 3 years ago. So,
but they didn't vote that way, right?
I don't know about that.
You think it was a stolen election?
Without a doubt.
The other day, Donald Trump said on his first day he's going to be a dictator for a day.
I like that. Yeah, I like that.
Would you rather have Donald Trump as a dictator for 4 years or reelect Joe Biden for 4 years?
I would rather have Donald Trump. I'd like to see the repeal of the Roosevelt Law so that he can be a president for a lot more than 4 years. But this country needs a dictator. I hate to say that, but it's the truth.
Donald Trump said in a speech that on day one, for a day, he would be a dictator. What do you think of that?
No idea. I don't know.
Would you rather have 4 years of Donald Trump as a dictator or 4 years of Joe Biden as a president?
Trump.
As a dictator?
Maybe.
Would you rather have four
okay,
years
we get of it. We get Donald it. Trump? We get it. The MAGA brains. Do you think those people actually know what's going on? Look, that farmer did a really great job yesterday explaining the 40 years. The 40 years of conservative talk, right-wing radio, conservative media, just pumping it into people's minds that you can't trust the mainstream media, that the Democrats are devils and feeding misinformation, and now it's an echo chamber.